Hi, everybody. My name is Stu Bram. I'm an alcoholic. And I want to thank Terry and the committee for inviting me here to share with you, and Jeff and Gary for taking me out to dinner before the meeting. And they said, do you get nervous before you speak? I said, yeah, but not too nervous I can't eat. You know? I didn't get this big not eating, trust me. And it's a pleasure being out here. I'm so with you, the grace of God. I knew that. My sobriety date is March the 12th, 1966. And I'm proving you can stay sober a long time, not amount to a damn thing. You know, the longer I stay sober, I start thinking about, I'm sitting there in that chair just thinking about, you know, where'd all these years go to? It just seemed like I was trying to get sober. Now, here it is 38 and a half years later, goodbye, and it's just unbelievable. I've had a very exciting trip coming out here. They offered to fly me out here. I said, no, I'll take a drive out here and take my time and stop and see some friends. And it's really neat. I stopped in Iowa City last night on the way out here at a little Motel 6 out there and checked in. I wanted to get to a meeting and went up to the girl at the desk. I found out where a meeting was downtown on 157th Street and Montrose Street. And I asked her, how did I get down there? She said, well, I know exactly where it is because I go there myself. So, and she was a member of the fellowship and showed me how to get to the meeting. And this is how God writes, you know, works through my life all the time. You know, the old people's ready, a teacher will appear. I used to go to meetings and I used to hear people talk about, I swore I would never be like my parent. My father or my mother, you know, they were a drunk. And I grew up with that kind of a life and I thought I would never, ever drink and be like them. And I also said the same thing, I would never be like my parents. And neither one of my parents drank or smoked. And, they lived the most boring life I thought I'd ever seen two human beings lived in my entire life. I always felt sorry for my father. It seemed like everybody was taking advantage of him because he didn't drink. And a lot of my friends, their parents drank, and I thought it was pretty cool. And so I'm a late bloomer as far as drinking started. I didn't have my first drink until about 14 years of age. And neither one of my parents drank. I'm one of seven children up to this day. None of my brothers and sisters have ever had a problem with drinking or drugs. Except for my youngest sister, just lately, she's the old theory, you know, if you start walking like a duck, quacking like a duck, wet feet like a duck, you might be a duck. And she's getting a little duckier lately. And, and so she may have a problem, so I'll save her seat just in case. And I've got two children. I got a son who's 46 years of age. I got a daughter, 42. And neither one of my kids have ever had a problem drinking or drugs. I got six grandchildren, from 27 down to 4, and none of them has ever had a problem so far with drinking or drugs. Three great-grandchildren haven't had a chance of getting training yet, but so I don't know when I drank, I try to make up for the whole damn family or what happened. Well, the first time I drank, I got drunk. I was on my way to a party. I was in the back seat of a 1949 Mercury, and we're going to a party. Now, I don't know how much my first Pepsi Cola cost, my first ice cream cost, but that first bottle of wine cost 51 cents. I never forgot that. That's 50 years ago, and I never forgot that. I got two of them. And I don't want to sit in the back seat. I want to sit in the front seat. I want to sit next to the window in case we see some pretty girls and take to the party. I want to like lean my arm over the window so it looks like I got a muscle or something, you know what I mean? Because my arms were skinny when I was 14. And pretend I had a muscle so I could talk to them, and they said, no, get in the back. So I got in the back seat, and I started, nothing else to do back there. I started working on those bottles of wine. I drank one before I got to the party. By the time I got to the party, I was so drunk, I couldn't hardly get out of the car. I got in the house. I remember I drank some more, and I remember I had my first blackout the first time I drank. Complete loss of memory. I know I fell in a bathtub that night. I know I couldn't get out of the tub for a while. I know I got sick that night. I know I leaned out a window to throw up. I wasn't used to throwing up drinking and everything. I leaned out the window. I fell out the window. And I thank God I was on the first floor, not on the second floor. Made a fool out of myself. I swore to God I wouldn't do this again, and yet I went back to it. I found something in that bottle. I never found any Kool-Aid or Pepsi Cola, iced tea, or anything I ever drank my whole life. I look back on my life. I was a weird, flaky, mixed-up kid before I ever started drinking. Hadn't been booze, it would have been drugs, it would have been something. And once I started drinking, it seemed like that was the answer to all of my problems. That little bottle of booze gave me the courage I was always lacking. Put a fire inside of me, made me get excited about life. Sort of like open the cage and let this lion come roaring out and go attack the world. And I don't know about you people, you know, talking about hiding a bottle around the house. Try to hide a 14, 15-year-old punk kid around your house one time who's drunk all the time. And that's what my parents are trying to do. They don't know what to do with it because they never seen nothing like this in their family. This is just weird. They tolerated it and hoped it would go away or would get better. They don't know what to do, so they just sort of like left it alone. But I drank almost every day, until I was 15 years of age. And I had access to a lot of booze. My father was in business, and people were always giving him booze for Christmas and gifts. Well, he never drank. And they had nothing against drinking. They just didn't drink. And he was storing it all up in the basement. And as he's storing it up down there, I'm down there working on it. And I'm taking it and taking the back shelf. And I'm filling the empty bottles with iced tea. And I'm drinking all his booze up as I could get. And then I got hooked up with a kid whose parents owned a bar. And my brother gave me a car when I was 16. And he had the bar and I had the car. Man, we were going to town, baby. We had it made. We had a wash tub in a trunk and full of ice and beer and going to school having a great time. And that's why I don't have a lot of education. So I was asked to leave school before I graduated. So I don't have a lot of formal education. I got kicked out of school when I was in my senior year. But I drank all the time. And I got married when I was 17. Now, most people don't get married when they're 17 unless one or two reasons. You're either crazy or someone's pregnant. That's why I got a 46-year-old son. And we were a little bit of both. And we got married, and I tried to convince everybody my son was born premature. We got married in April. He's born in July. And he weighed about 9.5 pounds. And I said, he's premature. And they kept telling me that the first one takes, it can come any time. The second kid's going to take you 9 months after you get married. So here I am. I'm dropping out of school. I got this girl pregnant. Back in the 50s, the thing to do was to get married. So we got married, and we had this child. I had to drop, I go get a job and work a couple jobs and drink. And I was a wild, crazy drunk even when I was a little kid. And I would not want to have been married to me. And trust me, we never would have gotten married if she wasn't pregnant. And then the following year, we had another child. Had two children. My time was 19. And I used that excuse to drink. Had all this pressure on you. You drink too. And then that child got sick and died. And I used that as an excuse to drink. If your daughter died, you drink also. And the more pressure, more reasons to drink, I'd sit and feel sorry for myself because my little girl died. And I used that as an excuse to drink. Anyway, you can find any excuse you want to drink. You keep looking out there, but bottom line, it's all in here. I drank because I was an alcoholic. I drank because I could not help but drink. And I was kind of drunk that I drank to get drunk. That's why I drank. And every time I went out to drink, I would never waste my time there for a drink. Let's go out and get drunk. That's what the name of the game was, drink to get drunk, you know. And with all this responsibility and everything, I found myself, getting a job in a factory on the waterfront up in Baltimore City. I lived in Anne Arundel County in a nice neighborhood. I grew up on a nice home on the river, nice family, nice community. Here I am, jumped into a marriage, and I started buying and renting houses here and there, and Nancy and I started moving around a lot, and I found it was cheaper to move and pay rent. And and so we lived down in the county, and I was an action drunk, a bar room drinker. I had fake ID cards, had all these responsibilities, so I drank anytime, anywhere. I was sort of big for my age as a kid, so I didn't have trouble getting served, so we lived down the county, and when I drank, my personality would really change. Now, our literature says, you want to see someone getting sober, look for a profound change in personality. Well, I had a profound change in my personality when I started drinking. I was a wild man, and I was a bar room drinker. I'm the kind of guy who would go out, And I'd be drinking somewhere, and someone said, hey, the ocean's only 2 hours away. Let's go down to Ocean City, Maryland. Close this place up and go down there and drink on the beach tonight. Well, I'm married. I got a couple of kids. Boom, down the ocean we go. I go with them. And we're down there drinking, partying on the beach, and the sun's starting to come up off the ocean. I'm thinking, hell, I didn't go home last night. Man, she is really going to be mad. I need a drink. And I start drinking. Who is she to tell me when I got to go home anyway? I'm already one day late. Why not be 2 days late? And 3 days late. One time I went out for drinking like 6 weeks later, 8 weeks later. Just irresponsible. I would not want to be married to a jerk like me. But that's the kind of guy I was. Just irresponsible. Immature. Mooed a lot when I was drinking. Like I told you, it's cheaper to lose pay rent. So I found myself getting into trouble. Also being an action drunk hanging in bar rooms. I found myself one night in a bar getting in a fight with these two guys. They told me they were off-duty police officers. And I said, well, you don't have a uniform. They showed me their badges. I said, you can get these at a trading post or something. You guys ain't cops. Well, next thing you know, I'm being locked up for assaulting two police officers, resisting arrest, disorderly conduct, even verbal assault because of my filthy mouth. And I got locked up, and I started getting in trouble with the police department in my small county. I happen to live in Anne Arundel County, outside of Annapolis, Maryland, in the Annapolis, Maryland area, AA County. And I found myself getting in trouble to the point I was put in a position I had to move out of the county. So I had to move to Baltimore City. I never lived in a city before in my entire life. So I moved to Baltimore City because I worked in a factory up in that area. And I moved in a high-rent district of West Baltimore on a little street, 1,800 block of Wilhelm Street, where you can rent a whole house for like $18 a week, $16 to $18 a week. Now, today, there's only two houses on that street that's not boarded up. And it was set in a terrible neighborhood. But I lived there for a couple years. I mean, I came home one night drunk, and I was paying $18 a week for this house. I saw a sign across the street in the window, house for rent, $17. I moved across the street to save a buck. You know, I do stupid things like that. My gas and electric get cut off, and I ran an extension cord out my kitchen window, down the wall into my neighbor's kitchen window. He plugged it in, I paid a difference on the gas and electric bill, so we got the gas and electric turned back on. Places are all roach infested. I don't know if you ever, out in the country, I don't know if you know about roaches, but they're all roach infested. You got them cockroaches running around, you know, and hell, nighttime, they get in your shoes, they get in your clothes, and under your collar. I went to work one day, and guys looking at me funny, when roaches had a tail out of my pocket. Going like that, you know. And we set them sulfur bombs off, and that would chase all the roaches out of your house, and they'd run out of your house, down our neighbor in his house. He'd set bombs off, and they said, we got these roaches running all over this place, setting these sulfur bombs out, but they always come back home. And a typical Saturday night on Wilhelm Street, living in this row house, and they were all row houses. They call them townhouses now because you get more money for a townhouse than a row house. So this was a row house, and a typical Saturday night on Wilhelm Street, you're sitting in your living room watching probably a stolen television, drinking beer, and your front door would bust open, and a guy would run in your house through your living room, dining room, kitchen, out your back door. And then here comes a cop coming in out the behind chasing you. It's your Saturday night entertainment on Wilhelm Street. I live like that. People talk about the fringe benefits of sobriety. You know what a fringe benefit is in my life today? If you go to my house where I live today in Savannah Park, I got a light bulb in every lamp. When I was drinking, I had two light bulbs. I had one in the kitchen and one in the bedroom. You got to go out of the bedroom to the bathroom. You take it out of the bedroom, put it in the bathroom. You go to the bathroom, you get done, take it out of the bathroom, put it in the kitchen. Downstairs, you take it out of the kitchen, take it in the living room. I could have stole light bulbs. I stole everything else. I wasn't thinking. And we lived like that. And then I started getting in trouble with the law in the city, so I decided the heat was off. I moved back down to the county. And this is what my drinking would do to me. I drank all the time. I drank every day. I drank anything. Well, my drinking took me to a point. I moved back to the county. So this here, I came up with a brilliant idea when I moved back to the county down off the Magazine River. In a little development called Manhattan Beach, individual homes, the people in the city who had a lot of money, all of them had a summer home. It was on the river. It wasn't insulated. Nice little house, little cottage, overlooking the river. Kids get out of school in June, spend the summer down on the river. September, they put them back into school. October, I'd move in their house. And I'd board it up, keep the, you know, wind out from the windows. There was no insulation. And I'd use it until the pipe would freeze over. And that's where I started living. And I started living in these kind of places. And I remember I was living in one of these kind of places, and I was on a bed drunk, and this is how my life was starting to take me. And I just reached a point I was so sick and tired of being sick and tired. My family was disgusted with me. My wife couldn't trust me or depend upon me. My kids had started to become ashamed of me, how I looked when I came home at times. Nobody, you know, everybody else was disgusted with me for a long time. That day I got disgusted with myself. I was riding down the highway thinking, what am I going to do about all this? Very depressed. I was thinking about suicide. I'm thinking, I probably can't even do that right. I probably end up being a paraplegic or a brain, you know, coma sometime for about a year, and I didn't have the courage to do that. I was attracted to a little church on the side of the road, and I just felt like at that time I had to talk to somebody or do something. I turned off God a long time ago. My little girl died. I don't want nothing to hear about God. Don't tell me about God. There's a loving God. Why did my little girl die? So I don't want to hear this God business, but I was attracted to this little church, and I found myself going up to that little church, pulling up there, talking to the minister of the church. I was 23 years of age, early spring, 1964. And I talked to the minister, and I told him about what was going on in my world. And he said, God, you got a lot. I told him all the problems I was having with my marriage and finances and job and everything. And he said, look, you got a lot of problems, but your biggest problem seems to be your drinking. And I can't help you. You get the drinking under control, I can help you with all the problems. But I'll tell you what, I can't help you, but I have a member of my congregation who can maybe help you. His name's Larry. And I'd like to introduce you to Larry. Now, I don't know what I was looking for, but I certainly didn't like what I had. I wasn't looking for Alcoholics Anonymous. I met Larry that night, and he told me the story about Alcoholics Anonymous and what it did in his life, and he would like to take me to a meeting. And I found myself going to my first meeting, 23 years of age, 41 years ago, almost. I went to that meeting, and I didn't realize what I got myself involved in. I couldn't quite understand it. He said, we'll go to another one tomorrow night. Went to another one, then the following night. Unfortunately, for young people, we bounced back pretty fast. Head started clearing up just a little bit. And he said, after the meeting, he said, because, see, I looked in the rooms of AA when I came there. I didn't see anybody young. Everybody to me looked like they were 100 years old. And it seemed like every one of them was talking about how much they drank and how long they drank. Some little lady here says she drank for like 30 years. And an old man over there says 35 and 40. I said, do it here, 42. We're here, 45. You know, it's like a contest how long they drank. I'm sitting there watching this. And we had guys in the group like Boxcar Smitty and Johnny Budweiser and guys with all these weird nicknames from out there drinking. And I'm thinking, what the hell is this? You know what I mean? And I found myself just thinking, you know, I don't know about this. So Larry said, after the meeting, I want to take you home. And I'm still shaking, too. And we didn't have the cassette tapes. We had this old reel-to-reel tape of a young speaker in AA he wanted me to listen to on this reel-to-reel tape. I said, okay, that sounds good. So after the meeting with his house, he put this tape on, this reel on, and Minerva fixed me a bowl, his wife fixed me a bowl of ice cream, put some Jimmies on top, and hadn't eaten ice cream in a long time. It was sickening sweet. And she had this Persian cat jumping all around the furniture. I'm trying to eat this ice cream, this is tape, and watch this cat, and I'm thinking, this is a typical Friday night for a young person in AA. You know? I got to get out of here. This ain't going to cut it. This ain't going to cut it. But you know what it dawned on me? I was as phony as you can find in Alcoholics Anonymous. We got a lot of phonies in AA. You know what? They don't throw none of us out. They didn't throw me out of AA because I was a phony. You know, I decided I'm going to use AA. Hell, I went around and told everybody I was in AA. Told my mother I'm going to Alcoholics Anonymous and life's going to be wonderful from now on. And she got a tear in her eye and come down like this. And my wife's happy and the landlord's going to get his rent. And my boss said, you're going to see what a 40-hour paycheck looks like. And I mean, kids are happy and everybody's excited except for one person, me. I don't want to be in AA. So after I got the heat off, I used it to get the heat off. And then I go to meetings to sort of fortify myself, remind myself I'm an alcoholic. And then after the meeting, I go down to the avenue in Baltimore City where all the action was. I was like a moth drawn to a flame. was fascinated with the bright lights and the women, the gambling, the fighting and everything. And I started going down there after meetings, and I tried to stay sober, associating drinking people with drinking people, with drinking places, doing drinking things. And the same thing happened to me that always happened to me. I got drunk. I drank. I came off that drunk. I didn't know I could come back to AA after I got drunk. I thought I was excommunicated out of AA. They said, no, you can go back. And I went back to Alcoholics Anonymous, and cut a long story short, they gave me two guarantees. Number one, if you think it's bad now, you take a drink, you ain't seen nothing yet. All these things are never, they're waiting for you. Keep drinking. If you don't die, they will happen to you. They got other guarantee. If you stay sober, even if things don't get better, you can get better. And if you get better, eventually things can get better. Anyway, I decided to go back to drinking. I don't need AA. And within 6 months, I'm back down these abandoned summer homes living. And I move a lot. I move so much, my boss told me to get a post office box. He started changing my address at work. And I move sometimes. I move twice in 1 week. I just keep moving. And moving a family out of U-Hauls. And so anyway, I end up living in one of these summer abandoned summer homes. I was drunk one night. I went absolutely, I've been on a 3-day binge, and I just went completely berserk. I was 24 years of age. I came home. I remember running my fist through the windows, the doors, the walls. I just went crazy. I tried to put my head through a concrete porch. And I remember end up in the hospital that night. Being sewed up, strapped down, sewed up, and they medicated me. I went and saw my family doctor the next day with my family, my parents, my wife, and the doctor says, "Dude, your biggest problem is you're drinking. Can't you stop drinking? You're 24 years of age." I said, "No, I want to drink right now." Well, they had new treatment centers back in those days. If they had it there, they were a little expensive or fancy, but we didn't have the treatment centers in those days. And so they took guys like me, and they just put us into a mental institution. And in my district, I went to Crownsville State Hospital. Locked ward, went into the Meyer building, into a locked ward. They take away your belt and your shoestrings, anything you may hurt yourself with, and you stay in there for about a 3-day evaluation, and then decide where they want to put you into the nut house, okay? And my 3-day evaluation came up, and they said, "We think you're an alcoholic, and you should go to College 15. I said, "What are you doing College 15? They said, "Well, you go up there and do a little work and go to meetings." I said, "Excuse me, I didn't come down here to work and go to meetings." They said, "We stay in the Meyer building." I said, "Fine." I stayed in a locked ward for 6 weeks. I could have been up on a hill smoking cigarettes, going to meetings, you know, walking around free. I didn't want to hear about this AA stuff. And in there, you know, we made these little ceramic ashtrays for therapy. We made leather wallets and belts and all kind of stuff. And they got tired of it after a while. They said, "Let's try something different. Let's try dancing as a therapy." They took all the nut girls out of this ward, all of us nut guys out of that ward, put us in a room like this, and they said, "Start dancing." They put a record player on. I'm a good dancer. I'm a little jitterbug guy. I'm a good dancer. I saw a cute little girl out there yesterday dance. I'm out there dancing around with this girl, you know, and I got my wrist all taped up, got my forehead taped up, and I'm looking cool. And she says, "What are you in here for?" I said, "They think I'm an alcoholic." She said, "No, I think you're trying to commit suicide." I said, "No." She said, "Yes, you did. Look at your wrist and all." I said, "No, I don't think so." I said, "What are you in here for?" She said, "I killed my husband." Now, I knew I was in an insane asylum, but I said, "You know, I may be crazy, but I'm not stupid. I'm getting me a new dance partner right now." And all I can tell you is the day I got out of there, I got drunk. And that's the story of my life. I was always getting drunk. Always getting drunk. I ended up moving back to the city because I got in trouble in the county. And so finally, through the grace of God, March of 12, 1966, I came up another really bad drunk. I'd been away for a while, and I don't usually tell this story, but I'm going to tell it tonight. I was on my last drunk, and I was down on Balmer Street, then out on Charles Street, and my last drinking was taking place in a bar called the Bucket of Blood. Okay. Nice high-class joint. You ever see a fight break in the bar and everybody breaks it up? In there, they lock the doors and let you fight it out. Okay? And I don't mean to be disrespectful, it's my story, though, but I got hooked up with a lesbian. And her and I were sitting there trying to find a woman that night. And we're both drunk, and no other lesbian wanted to deal with her, and no woman wanted to deal with me. So her and I spent my last drinking night together in a room, and I think she told me she's bisexual or something. So, but here I am, a great lover, and here I am. This is how I'm ending up at the end of the road here. I'm bragging to these guys what a great lover I am. I mean, this lesbian is staying together, okay? So I sneak out in the morning out of room, and I get down to a bar in Barnum Highlands that opened at 6 o'clock. And I remember finishing getting drunk in there again all over again. I remember a guy picked me up off of a men's room floor and took me home. And I'd been laying on that floor, and I was dirty and sweaty, and I'd gotten dirty in my clothes, and it's on the filthy floor in this bar room. And he took me home, and I was so ashamed of myself. Look at me, I'm so filthy, and wearing my half my lost weekend. And I remember he pulled up in front of my house, and here again, living back in these row houses again, but these are a little bit better row houses. And I said, look, don't let me off in front of my house. Take me around the back, up the alley, let me go into the back of the house. I'm just so ashamed of myself. Went around back, hell, everybody's back there washing the car and everything, you know. Take me around the front. So I go in the front and open the door, and I walk in, and I walk by the shadow box mirror in my house, and I looked in and looked like a monster staring back at me. I was scared to death, and I went up and shook that drunk out, and I found myself shaking, and through the grace of God, I don't know what made me think about it, was, you know, call AA again. I came back to Alcoholics Anonymous March 12, 1966, and I've been here ever since, a day at a time, without taking a drink. I found there's a big difference between being around AA and being in AA. First time I came around AA, it's sort of like your bed. You go to your room tonight, pull your bed out on the little floor. You can walk around your bed all night long. You can walk around there, look at it, get in there, smell it, touch it. Don't mean nothing until you get in it. A is the same thing. I came around AA. I never joined AA. I came around, never joined it, and never really used a sponsor, joined a group. You know, I was sitting in a chair waiting for something to happen. It ain't going to happen. I heard a speaker one time, you know, said, if it's that easy, just sitting in a chair waiting for something to happen, go home tonight, take a chair, put in your garage, sit in it, see if you turn into a car. Okay? It ain't going to happen. And just sitting in a chair, it ain't going to happen. It's a good way to get started, but it ain't going to just happen. So I joined AA when I came back. I called AA, found out where the meeting was. I came back, and I joined Alcoholics Anonymous. Put my name on the book, put my sobriety date, phone number, got myself a sponsor, got hooked up with some sober people, got active, started going to a lot of meetings. I asked my sponsor, how often should I go to meetings? He said, how often did you drink? I said, I drank every day. He said, go to meetings every day. I said, I don't have a car. I live in the country. How am I going to get to the meetings? He said, you didn't need a car to get drunk. You don't need a car to get sober. You get to meetings, we'll get you home. But you got to go to meetings. So I started going to meetings. I hitchhiked to meetings. I catch buses to meetings. I'd walk to meetings. Guys would pick me up and take me to meetings. I would just go to meetings. I remember when I was early in AA, I guess I was sober a week. My sponsor said, hey, there's a new man at the door. Go talk to him. I said, what am I going to tell him? I got 7 days. You got 2 years. You go talk to him. He said, tell him about your 7 days. He doesn't have 7 days. Trust me, he's not going to get sober through the grace of stew, okay? He's going to get sober through the grace of God. Go talk to him. I just got active. I started working with a lot of drunks. And because I started staying sober, all the old drunks would turn the young drunks over to me. I started working with a lot of young drunks. I had the privilege in 1966. I got hooked up with some guys. They said, hey, we're going to Bill Wilson's anniversary in New York. I said, who's Bill Wilson? They said, all he is a co-founder of the program, Save Your Life. At least before the old man dies, you can go up there and thank him in person. I said, all right, I'm willing. So five of us hop in a car in 1966 in October. We go to New York. Went to Bill Wilson's anniversary. Saturday morning, have a little out-of-towners meeting for all the new people there. And we went in this little room, and Bill Lewis came down and talked to us. And we had a chance to listen to him tell the stories. And then we went and got in a big circle, went in our room, had a chance to walk up and shake his hand and say a few words to him. And I never forgot, I said, Bill, I just want to thank God for letting him use you as an instrument find the program that saved my life. And all he said was pass it on. He didn't say, you know, go back and take a third step. Well, it's good to see you. Look good today. He said, pass it on. And that's our primary purpose in Alcoholics Anonymous. Stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. Passing it on. Doesn't say anybody's got to accept it. Says we have to pass it on. I went back 3 more of his anniversary before he died. I didn't realize the privilege I had until I did it later on, years down the road. So I had that real privilege. I really feel good about that today. I had a bunch of young guys in Boston. They said, well, how's your young people's meeting in Baltimore? I said, we don't have one. They said, start one. Start a young people's meeting. And I was sober almost a year, and I got my license back. Bought myself my first car, NAA. Nice car. It was an old taxi cab they took off the streets of Baltimore that was unsafe to drive. I bought it for $50. Had a connection there. Took the dome off the top where the wires came through to light the light up. Put some duct tape over the paint, the hose. I took some spray paint on the doors. It was Veterans GI taxi cab. It was red, white, and blue. And even when I did all this, it still looked like a taxi cab. In fact, I remember taking my little girl down to downtown Baltimore one day, and we're riding downtown. It still looked like a cab. Everybody's going like this. And my little girl said, God, Dad, you're an AA. Everybody knows you, don't they? I said, that's right, baby. That's what this is all about. That's what this is all about. And I did things like that. And I started working with a lot of young drunks. I remember taking a bunch of young drunks in their 20s, taking them to meetings back in like 66, 67. And there weren't a lot of young people staying sober back in them days. And I take them to a meeting, and they say, well, where's all the young people at? I said, they're on the other side of of town. We'll go there Tuesday night, and you'll meet some young people. There wasn't anybody young staying sober across town. So I take them over, and they say, well, where are they at? I said, they must be on the Friday night meeting on the other side of town. I told my sponsor I wasn't lying to him. Maybe I was romancing the truth a little bit. But I was just trying to buy him some time to make him realize age doesn't mean nothing. Doesn't mean nothing. To realize what's available here for him if they want it. Now, what's funny is all these years go by, and now I'm in my 60s, I'm working with an old bunch of old guys. I take them to a typical meeting. They look around and say, where the hell's all the old people at around here? All I see is young people. I said, they're on the other side of town. So it doesn't really matter whether you're old or young. The important thing is you're here. You don't get here a day too soon or a day. You get here right when God wants you to get here. And we're blessed to be able to stay here. So I got active, got involved, started working with a lot of drunks, went back to school, had a speech impediment. When I got sober, I found out talking fast, I don't stutter. I used to stutter a lot. I found talking fast, I don't stutter. I used to always go around meetings, I was always squinching. I was like, what's the matter with you? I said, I can't see. He said, get a pair of glasses. I said, I look better without them. He said, you're not here to win a beauty contest. You're here to get sober. I used to talk like this all the time. Yeah, well, you know, it's okay. He said, get your hand out of your mouth. I said, half my teeth are missing. Stay sober and buy some new ones. I got new teeth. It's amazing what we can find in this program if we really wanted to hang in here long enough and look for it. Found myself, you know, working this factory for a long time and staying sober. Had a lot of success. A lot of nice things happened to me. You know, probably worst thing happened to me again. I got my credit back too soon, but finally got that straightened away. And life's going good. I mean, I have a very exciting life, and nice things are happening. I went back to night school and got a GED. You know why I got my GED? I didn't get it because I didn't need it. I did it for my father. You go to my house, my father has 6th grade education. He wanted all the kids to get an education, and he hung all the diplomas up on the wall. They got to my place, he went, boop. I got it for him to put in that space to make him feel good. And I got it, that little GED meant as much as my brother's college degree. I did it for him. You have to make some amends when we get sober. Get right with our family, our friends. I started doing things like that. I got active in AA. Started working with a lot of drunks. My 3rd anniversary in AA, I guarantee I must have worked with I know I must have sponsored 100 young drunks in AA. But none of them were sober. But I was. And that's what this thing's all about. When it first off. Life got exciting. Went on down the road to recovery. Things are going great. Nancy and I was having problems every now and then. And then about, we separated a few times, went back and forth, separated, going back together. And finally, I guess about 18 years or so ago, we decided to separate, go ahead and file for a divorce. And we were both very active, very involved in the program. It was going to affect a lot of people. We saw other people in the program going through divorces. And some people teach us some things what to do, and other people teach you things what not to do. And we wanted to keep it out of AA. And we both belonged to the same groups and all that kind of stuff, went to the same meeting. So we sat down and decided that we're going to separate. I moved in with an old man in AA. He was a widower. She moved. She stayed in the house. We signed a little voluntary separation agreement of 2 years, which means we couldn't get a divorce for 2 years. Give us time to get some counseling, try to work this thing out, see if can we resolve it. And if not, we will finalize it. And after almost 3 years, we went ahead, got a divorce, finalized. We got the divorce, and it was amicable. And the thing we did about it was she said, well, I'd like to go to state convention. I said, well, you go to state convention, I'll go to session monitor. So we never crossed paths at a meeting in Alcoholics Anonymous from that day on. She said, I like the Thursday night security group. I said, then I'll go to Lincoln Thursday night. I like Tuesday, Marley. I said, I'll go here in Pasadena. And we never brought it in to put our friends in Alcoholics Anonymous in a situation they had to choose sides or an embarrassment or anything else. We kept it out of there. Yet all of our friends, our sponsors, everybody knew about it. We just didn't bring it and dump our garbage in here. And it worked out. We got a divorce. It was amicable to the point we still stayed friends. And then neither one of us ever remarried. And then about 3 years ago, this coming December, she called me up. And she said, remember that cancer, a little tumor I had before, and I had cancer, and they cut it out, and she said, well, it's back. I said, wow, I'm sorry to hear that. She said, I'm in the hospital in Annapolis, and maybe you can call the kids and get the kids here, and it doesn't look too good. And I said, well, I'll call my daughter. She was living in California. My son was in Florida. I said, I'll call them, and I said, would it be okay if I came down too? She said, that would be great. So I called the kids, picked them up at the airport, took them to the hospital. They flew in from across the country, and went down, saw her, and found out that Nancy was suffering from melanoma cancer. It was terminal in her case. And the doctor gave her about 6 months to live. She was 60 years, not quite 61 years of age. And I got involved in her to the point, and I was dating this gal, Kathy, at this time. And I told Kathy what was happening with Nancy, and she said, look, she's the mother of your children. You've known her since she's 13 years of age. We're engaged, but hey, I'll see you when I see you. Do what you got to do to help take care of her. That's part of your responsibility, and God bless you, and God bless her. And just do what you can to help her out. And basically, I almost moved in with her to help take care of her for the next 6 months. And my daughter and a lot of the Al-9 gals, she dropped out of Al-9 about 8 years prior to this, and Al-9 girls all started showing up, and we took shifts and turns trying to take care of her, and we had to feed her and help her get to the bathroom, and she was bedridden at home, and I stayed down there, and I'd go down every day, and I'd help take care of her with the rest of her family and friends of ours. And I remember being down there one day, and she was a very strong girl, and she got involved with church and found her higher power that she could, she chose to be with. I remember her crying down there one day. She started crying. She would never cry in front of anybody. She's crying this one day, and I held her in my arms, and I held her, and I said, I am so sorry you're going through all this. And I started crying myself. I said, Nancy, if there's any way I could trade places with you, I swear to God I'd do it in a heartbeat. And she said, you know what, I knew you would. And she said, I just want you to forgive me. Any kind of pain I've ever caused you in your entire life, anything I do, I wish I could do it. She said, look, I forgave you a long time ago. When are you going to forgive yourself? And I want you to forgive me also. And we held each other and told each other we loved each other, and we both cried. What a gift God gave me that day. What a gift. I was with her all the way up to May the 8th, 1:15 in the morning, when she passed away. My children and all of us by her bedside. And my son couldn't believe that I would do this for my ex-wife, who had been divorced for like 16 years, that I would do this. And I said, that's what love's all about. And that's what this program has taught me how to do, how to conduct myself. And it's my part of my responsibility. So I went in and took care of all that. And my son-in-law said, my father would never have done that for my mother when they were divorced. I said, maybe your father's not in a program called Alcoholics Anonymous, and give him a set of principles and a higher power to guide him along the way. And so we went through all that kind of stuff. Then about, and what happened was that brought me and my family closer together. And it brought my son-in-law and my daughter and myself closer together, and my grandchildren. It brought us all closer together. And then one day my grandson calls me up, my son-in-law calls me up, and he says, Stu, come on up here. We need to talk to you about something. And I said, what do you want to talk about? And he said, come on up here. We want to talk to you. So I go to their house, and my son-in-law, trust me, I'm just a poor, I'm proved to stay sober, not become nothing. You know what I mean? And the process of me working my way out of the factory, I got into sales. I've sold insurance. I've sold real estate. I'm a hustler. I'm a go-getter. When I was 50 years of age, I hung it all up, and I decided to join the flea market crowd. And I got rid of my suits and ties in my car. I bought a van, and I started going to flea markets, and I got caught up with these old penny postcards. A guy was sponsored and taught me about them, and I started buying and selling. We on down. Next thing you know, I ended up with like 400,000 penny postcards, and they're all cataloged and antique, and I'm selling them at shows. I'm traveling all over the country, and for 13 years, I lived like a modern-day gypsy. Before I bought my trailer, I'd sleep in my van. It's called the Van Hilton. And I travel all over the country, in California to Maine to Florida, Wisconsin, just buying and selling, we owned deal, and I loved it. Dressed up for me at a show was wearing a pair of cutoffs and a tank top, you know, not this kind of stuff. And I did that for almost 13 years, and then I retired, at the perfect time when Nancy got sick. I was there to take care of her. And after I took care of her, my son-in-law says, I want you to come up to the house for dinner. I came up for dinner. He says, you know what? He said, you know, you're for real. My daughter kept telling her that my father's for real. He said, I found that you were for real the way you conducted yourself with Nancy and her death. He said, we're going to take care of you. I said, you're going to take care of me. I said, man, I'm sober a long time. I've had a lot of good luck. My house is paid for. I don't have new bills, no debts. I'll be able to retire. I got a little pension coming in, full Social Security. I'm living fine. He said, no, but look, we're going to take care of you. I said, look, you don't have to. He said, if we couldn't afford to do this, we wouldn't do it. He said, you're the only grandparent my children have left. Both my parents are dead. Nancy's dead. You're the only one left, my children. My son-in-law's up. President of a large corporation. They do a lot of sports and entertainment work. They have 215,000 employees. Okay? You got 75 vice presidents under him. Makes a lot of money. God bless him. Taking care of my daughter. So he buys me a big 63-inch TV and he starts giving me things. Comes down to my anniversary and gives me an anniversary card, and I open up the anniversary card. God, there's a check in there for $10,000. Cal, I start crying. I said, geez. He said, you ain't seen nothing yet. Inside, I'm saying, yes. Yeah. And he says, you ain't seen nothing. He said, we're going to take care of you. I told you we're going to take care of you. And he said, I'll give you an example. He'll do things for me. September the 18th, 2 weeks before that, he calls me up. Said, what are you doing the weekend of September the 18th? I ain't doing nothing. He said, you want to go for a wild weekend? I said, yeah, sounds good. He said, be at my house Friday night on the 17th, September. I go there. Next morning, he has a limo pick us up, take us to the airport. We fly first class out to Las Vegas. He's got ringside seats for Oscar De La Hoya fight and Bernard Hopkins fight. We eat dinner at the Knob Hill restaurant, MGM Grand Hotel. We have a great evening. The next morning we get up, he's got an SUV sitting there. We drive to L.A. We go to the Emmys. Okay. He said, now the only way to get an Emmy is you got to get on the red carpet. So he has a big stretch limo, pick us up at 3 o'clock, take us to the Emmys. We pull up there. We finally get up at the red carpet. We get out, and I'm walking up there. I got my nice new suit on. I'm walking up there, strutting up there, you know. Inside, then I start laughing. He said, what's the matter? I said, hell, this is a long way from Crownsville State Hospital. You know what I mean? I don't want to forget where I came from here, you know. And we go into the Shrine Auditorium for the show, and after we go to the Governor's Ball and have dinner with all the celebrities and everybody famous, get back, and we go back to the hotel. The next morning, we fly first class back to Philadelphia. Go to Monday Night Football game with the Eagles and you know, the Vikings. And he does things like that. 2 weeks from now, he's going to take me and Kathy to the island of Nevis for a week's vacation, Caribbean, stay at the Four Seasons, five-star hotel, suite right on the ocean, flying first class. He said, "You ain't seen nothing yet." I said, "Yes." I'm living an American dream, man. I'm living a dream. He said, look, he offered me tickets one time to see a band called Aerosmith and Cheap Trick. He said, when you took those tickets, I knew you'd go anywhere. He said, I wouldn't go see Cheap Trick and Aerosmith, but you will. I said, yeah, I know. So anyway, we had a nice, I'm having an exciting time. I'm having a lot of fun. Plus, if we want AA, work with drunks. My life's exciting. October 16th, year ago. I've been living, doing some light housekeeping with this young lady called Kathy. I've known Kathy 20 years. She moved in about 13 years ago. I gave her a ring, so we're going to get married. We believe in long engagements. And then I start feeling embarrassed around my grandchildren. I'm Pop-Pop, and she's Aunt Kathy. I can feel funny going to meet and talk about spirituality. I'm shacking up. Now, it's each his own. I've been there. I've done it. But I want to try to make it right. So I said, Kathy, what do you say we get married? We've both been married once before. Let's try it again. How? I've known you 20 years. If we've been together 13 years. It ain't going to work out. We'll get a divorce. But we ought to know by now. So she said, okay. We went down, got a license. We had a big wedding. Big wedding. Went to the courthouse. Me, her, and the justice of peace. I told her I'd pay for everything. Just me, her, and the justice of peace. Went down on Tuesday. Got our license. Thursday, we went down to the courthouse. Waited our turn. We got married. It took a long. It was boat week in Annapolis. Sailing capital of the world. It was boat week. Took longer to find a place to park than we did to get married. Found a place to park, went in, waited a turn, we got married. Her and I were all dressed up in nice clothes. Had a little chapel there, just a piece in the courthouse, and Kathy and I. It was important for us. Went and told our parents. Never forget, went and told her father and mother we got married. She says, we didn't tell them we got married. We went up to the house, and I showed them the, like the certificate. And they can't see good, and they're in their late 80s. And they're like this. And my mother said, what'd you do now? And if I said, they got married. And they were all happy and excited, started crying. Went and told my daughter, it was her birthday, we got married on her birthday. Hell, she got married on my birthday, May the 21st. She's all excited and happy. He said, we've been waiting for you to get married, we got something for you. Comes another little check. Another gift. God bless him. I said, this bird may never fly all the way forever, so you just get what you can get while you can get it. This goose may die. You never know. You know what I mean? So just enjoy it and appreciate it. And what we do to repay him, I can't give him nothing. What I do to repay it is I offer to go watch your kids every chance I can so they can maybe get away every now and then and do a little something by themselves. You know, they live the good life. I sit back and watch them. Takes her to Paris for her birthday. You know, they live the rich and famous life. I go up there and cut the grass. So Kathy and I get married, and now we've married. God, it's almost 13 months. Haven't cheated on her in 13 months. Haven't lied to her. We live a good life. She's a pianist. Teaches music. Kids come to the house. We never change their name. My name is Steve Ramble. Hers is Kathy Harris. All the kids come to the house. Hi, Mr. Harris. I said, how you doing, Johnny? You know, put the check on the table. But we live an exciting life. We have a lot of fun. I have an exciting life in Alcoholics Anonymous. And these 13 years of drifting around AA, all around, and I went to meetings all over the country, but I wasn't like, I couldn't be involved with a lot of drunks and work with a lot of drunks because I was always on the road. I spent the winter in Florida. I mean, somebody's got to do it. So I'd go to Florida and spend the winter because that's where the money went, and I'd follow the money trail. And I'd go down and hustle and buy and sell, and I did pretty good. And so anyway, comes along, you know, we got married and all. I just lost my train of thought. That hadn't happened to me in years. That's good for me. It makes me humble. But anyway, what had happened, I know where I was. So what happened was I couldn't get involved with a lot of drunks. And I love working with drunks. I love working with drunks. And I belong to this little home group about 20-some miles from it. And I love that group. But I meet a drunk there, and he lived 20 miles the other way, and now we're 40 miles apart. And I looked around, there was a meeting like less than 1 mile from my house. And it mostly has these tight-lipped, blue-haired little ladies in there. But they're really nice gals, and they're neat, and there's a lot of sobriety in that little group. It's a freedom group on Wednesday night in Savannah Park at 7:30. Started going there, and I decided I'm going to join that group and get in there. Maybe I become a coffee maker or something and help out that group a little bit, make some coffee for them, and join that group and meet some drunks living right in my neighborhood. I got involved with a guy that his sponsor was dying. He said, I'm going to need a new sponsor. And I sort of like drifted away from AA. I was going to AA, but I wasn't going to meetings as much. I was on the road all the time. And I'm going to tell you, there's no other greater gift in the world than working with another drunk in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I hadn't sponsored anybody in quite a while. I think you should have a sponsor that you can sit down eyeball to eyeball and look at. It's nice to, you know, have a sponsor like in Kalamazoo or Tampa. But I need a sponsor I can sit down eyeball to eyeball and look. And so this guy comes up to me and says, I need a sponsor. I said, all right, I'll sponsor you. He said, well, I got to go to the meeting tomorrow night. I said, damn, now I got to go to the next meeting. And by all I'm telling you is by working with this drunk, he forced me to get back involved and active in Alcoholics Anonymous. I used to speak a lot years and years ago. I don't speak much anymore. I went one time like 5 years without speaking in Alcoholics Anonymous. I found out you can stay sober not speaking AA. I got friends of mine that go 6,000 miles speaking. They will go 6 blocks to listen. Okay? So I found out I can stay sober without speaking. I think it's important you listen in Alcoholics Anonymous. In fact, I think you should listen twice as much as you talk. That's why God gave you 2 ears and 1 mouth. You ever figure that one out? You get 2 ears and 1 mouth, maybe you should listen twice as much as you talk. Otherwise, you'd have 2 big mouths and 1 big ear right here in the front of your face. You know what I mean? And so I'm not afraid to go to a meeting and sit down and just listen. I want these guys to convince you can have a lot of fun being sober. You can have a lot of fun being sober. I went to meet one night, and a little lady walks up to me. She says, dude, are you really happy in AA? I said, yeah. She said, when are you going to tell your face about it? Don't be afraid to smile. Don't take yourself so serious. Learn to have fun being sober. And I have a lot of fun being sober. I think if you're not having fun and you're not enjoying yourself being sober, somewhere you miss something. Now, I know it ain't fun when you go through tragedies like I went through with Nancy and all. But overall, if you're not having fun and you've been around here for a while, somewhere you missed something. AA is not an endurance contest. It's not a place you just come in here and hang in. It's a place where you start the living, the joy of good living. Have some fun. I remember I used to go talk sometime, and I was sober, I don't know, 8, 10 years in AA, and I'd go to meetings. I remember one time I went and saw a friend of mine named Millie Copeland. God bless her, she died sober a long time in AA. And Millie was a big, heavy-set woman, living on the Outer Banks of North Carolina. Went down to see her, and her and I went up and laid on the beach. It looked like a couple of whales had moved up on the beach. And I said, Millie, I said, I don't hear the things I used to hear in AA when I was first came in AA. She said, then why don't you say them? And that's our responsibility in here. We owe the drunk the truth. We don't need to water this thing down. Tell them like it is. It was good enough to get you sober and keep you sober. It's going to be good enough for the next guy or gal to come down the road. Pass it on. So I thank God I had a chance to meet Bill Wilson. I had a chance to learn about passing along for our primary purpose. It's the little things that I use in Alcoholics Anonymous to keep me sober, not the big profound changes. Someone told me one night, bend my knees before I bend my elbow. Don't be afraid to pray. Ask God to help you stay sober. Thank Him when you go to bed tonight. It's the little things. You ever notice we develop a whole new vocabulary in Alcoholics Anonymous? I don't know about you. I learned a whole new set of words since I came here. New words like, excuse me, thank you, please, I'm sorry. See, I've never had a problem staying sober in an AA meeting. No one's ever came up and offered me a drink at an AA meeting. My problem has never been in here. My problem is out there when I leave here. How do I live out there? Well, I try to practice out there what I'm taught in here. Now, my sponsor, when I first started learning how to do this, I didn't know how to live out there. I was on my best behavior in meetings. I go home. I didn't know how to behave. And my sponsor was the first man I really ever loved in my entire life as a human being. And he knew I loved him and respected him. So he said, I'll tell you what, when you go home tonight, if you don't know how to behave in your house when you leave this meeting, pretend I'm sitting in the living room watching you all night long. And when you go to work tomorrow, pretend I'm standing on the side of you working with you all day long. When you ride down the road, if you don't know how to ride down the road without trying to pick up a woman or something, pretend I'm sitting in either the back seat or in the car behind you, watching you. Would you do this if I was there? Fake it till you make it. But eventually you'll find out you don't have to pretend he's in the living room. He's in the back seat or next to you. It becomes a way of life. Not that you're going to be perfect. Not that you're going to take yourself so serious. But you learn to enjoy being sober, enjoying this life. I'm in the process now, wrap it up, I'm in the process now of taking care of my father. My father will be 93 years old in February. Never used a walker or a cane or nothing. Just hope the apple didn't fall far from the tree. He's in a little assisted living home on the eastern shore of Maryland, about an hour's drive from me. I go down at least twice a week and see him. 93 years old. He liked that assisted living home down. I said, why don't you come up? He said, I like this one down here. You know why I like it? There's 70 people in this assisted living home. 60 women and 10 men. He is like an old rooster in a hen house. I get embarrassed sometimes. You know, he fell a couple weeks ago, about, I guess 8 weeks ago, he fell and cracked his pelvis. Ended up in a nursing home for a while. Now he's all fired up, ready to go back to the assisted living home. Has all the girls writing him and calling him. And he's got a couple girlfriends. And I'm telling you, he is a character, man. His mind is so sharp. Gets around a little slower now, but I took him to the doctor's last Tuesday before I left to come here, get this pelvis checked out. Well, he was using a walker. There for a while, he was in a wheelchair. Then he was in a walker. And I take him to the doctor, and I said, I'm thinking of seeing an orthopedic specialist because get that hip checked out, make sure everything's okay. He said, I'm thinking, I don't know. He takes three steps to put his walker down. Three steps to put his walker down. Three steps. Went in there, orthopedic surgeon, checking them all out, twisted his ankles, legs. He said, how? He said, you're healed. He said, you know, it takes 8 weeks for that thing to heal up. He said, you've been 7 weeks and like 4 days. Three more days, you're perfectly healed. You're healed now. He said, you got to be kidding me. He said, no. He said, yeah. He said, the only therapy I'm going to give you is a pat on the back and say, good job. I took him out of there. The old man said, I'll go get the car. He said, now, wait a minute. He took 30 steps, put the walker down. 30 steps. I felt like I just came from the Jimmy Swagger revival or something, you know, where the old man was healed. And he just needed that reassurance of someone telling him everything's going to be okay, someone professionally. And so anyway, I'm taking care of him. He gave me a power. Now, all my kids, my brothers and sisters, all of them, and he chose me to give the power of attorney to. He said, I want you to take care of me. I said, Dad, I took care of you. You took care of me when I was a little boy. I'm going to take care of you now that you're an old man. He said, I would like that. I want you to be the power of attorney. So I go see him every week, twice a week, go take him out to dinner. So my life is exciting. I live in a nice neighborhood now. I live in a little town called Severna Park. It's got it spelled wrong, but it's Severna Park. And S-E-V-E-R-N-A. And little community. Nice community. I was in real estate for a while, and I was in the right place, right time. Bought a house in this neighborhood. I couldn't afford to live in there otherwise. When I was a kid, I used to go in this neighborhood. I lived on the outskirts of this neighborhood called Severna Park. I lived in the Divine Creek area. And we would have our jeans on and our t-shirts, and we had a hair comb bag, tough guys, and these little kids in this neighborhood, rich little kids, had little button-down collars on shirts and little belts on the back of their pants, little white shoes, and we had our DAs and all. We go in and we beat up these little kids. Hell, now I'm living in that neighborhood. Took Kathy out to dinner not too long ago. We're sitting there eating dinner. I started laughing. She said, what's the matter? I said, hell, I robbed this place one time. It's amazing. You know, they talk about recycling bottles and tin cans and paper. AA and God's recycling us. He's recycling the outcasts of society called alcoholics, bringing them in here, and we're recycling them through the grace of God. We turn them out there better than they probably were in the first place. I know I'm a better person than I ever was my entire life. I thank God for alcoholics and honest. You saved my life. Everything I've got near and dear to me today, I owe to the fact I'm sober in alcoholics and honest. Coming here and getting sober and staying sober. How about easier staying sober than getting sober? It's been the greatest thing happening in my entire life. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I love being sober. Love being here, and I hope I said something that will help just one other drunk in this room tonight. If not, thank you very much, and God bless you.
We hope you've enjoyed this recording. To obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.